Paul Dreesen, J.D., is Senior Policy Advisor for the Congress of Racial Equality and the author of Eco-Imperialism, Green Power, Black Death. His presentation is titled DDT, Biotechnology, and Eco-Imperialism.
There we go. All right. It's an honor to be here. I've enjoyed meeting some of you already and look forward to meeting all the rest of you over the coming hours here before I head back on the red eye back to D.C. on Sunday evening. Let me tell you a little bit about myself before I get going on my program. I am, or I was, whatever you want to call it, an Eagle Scout. I grew up on the Fox River in Wisconsin, which is one of the most heavily paper-milled rivers in the world. When I grew up, you couldn't eat the fish, you couldn't catch many fish, you certainly didn't want to cook the fish in your kitchen, and absolutely you didn't want to eat them. There were very few waterfowl, no eagles in the area. But I got involved in the environmental movement partly as a result of that, just my disgust with the way things were and the amount of pollution in the rivers and air in that area. I actually grew up about 2 blocks away from one of those paper mills and about the same distance to the river. I got involved in Sierra Club, zero population growth. I helped organize the very first Earth Day on my college campus. And over the years, I watched as that river improved. And now you can eat the fish, you can swim in the river. We used to joke that you could play Jesus Christ and walk across the river at times. We can't do that anymore. We have 6 pairs of nesting eagles right down below my home along the river. And it's an incredible transformation. It's the sort of thing the environmental movement helped to generate. And so I've long considered myself an environmentalist. But at the same time, I have broken with the environmental movement, much as a colleague of mine, Patrick Moore, has from Greenpeace. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. First, do no harm. How many times have you all heard that? And in fact, how many times have you heard speakers launch into their discussions with this shop-worn phrase? So the question is, why am I doing it? The reason is that it's not only appropriate, but it's an essential element of what I believe the developed nations are doing to developing countries through their aid programs, environmental ideologies, and political agendas like sustainable development and the precautionary principle. We are harming them instead of helping and healing them. Take foreign aid, for example. The chairman of Nigeria's Economic and Financial Crimes Commission recently reported that some $400 billion, and that's with a B, dollars was stolen, squandered, or lost, and I love that term, lost, just by Nigerian leaders during the last 4 decades of the 20th century. And even by Washington standards, that's quite significant money. And regardless of what Tony Blair and Bob Geldof and Rockers for Africa might think, I don't think the answer is to provide more aid and forgive more debts, send more billions off to these countries, to bureaucrats, and to prop up corrupt dictators who end up sending about 80% of all this foreign aid off to their families, their political allies, their military machines, and their Swiss bank accounts. The answer, in my view, is measures that will improve transparency and accountability and reduce the corruption, expand free trade, and control diseases so that people in these countries can be healthy enough to work and care for their families and generate new prosperity. On the ideological front, healthy, well-off Americans and European activists worry themselves almost sick over wildly speculative risks associated with chemicals, biotechnology, and electricity generation. Meanwhile, they studiously ignore the clear and often extraordinary benefits of using these technologies. They ignore the pernicious harm that their technophobia is having on the most powerless, destitute, diseased, malnourished, and energy-deprived people on our planet. To paraphrase H.L. Mencken, the whole aim of modern environmentalism, it seems, is to keep the populace alarmed and hence clamorous to be led to safety by menacing it with an endless series of hobgoblins, all of them imaginary. And so professional worrywarts promote ultra precaution, and tell sick, starving parents and children in Africa, Asia, and Latin America that they simply must not adopt modern technology, electricity, biotechnology, and pesticides, for example. These technologies, they say, might pose barely detectable risks to nervous Europeans and wouldn't be sustainable. And indeed, the activist principal rallying cry today is sustainable development. The notion that we are running out of various resources, compromising the needs of future generations, and poisoning our earth, leading inevitably to an ecological Armageddon. Thus, they justify all kinds of demands and restrictions, most of which cause the most serious harm to America's and the world's poorest people, the very ones they purport to care so much about. For example, they oppose electricity generation. Let's see if we can get this thing to go. No. There we go. Solar panels on huts are okay, as are gigantic bird-killing wind turbines. But hydroelectric projects dam up rivers. Fossil fuels cause global warming, and nuclear power would be simply disastrous. The result is that 2 billion people, nearly a third of the world's, over a third of the population of the world, well, nearly a third, continue to struggle without the health, social, and economic benefits that abundant, reliable, affordable electricity would bring. 2 billion people around the world try to survive on less than $500 per person per year. And 10 million of them die every single year from lung infections and intestinal diseases that would largely disappear if these people had electricity. By banning biotechnology, sustainability elitists keep third world farmers from growing larger quantities of more nutritious food that resist insects and disease, grow better in saline and nutrient-poor soils, and require fewer pesticides and fertilizers. As a result, at least partly as a result, 11 million people die annually from malnutrition and diseases that they would survive, probably, if they were not so malnourished. The European Union has even gone so far as to threaten to ban agricultural imports from any African country that dares to use biotechnology. I think there's something absurd and perverse about healthy, well-fed, even obese Europeans saying that malnourished Africans must sacrifice their children's nutrition and health on the altar of Euro-paranoia. But it's even worse than the EU when the EU tries to justify its precautionary principle as being socially responsible and moral and scientifically sound. Then there is USAID and UNICEF and World Health Organization, or WHO. They're supposed to help all people attain the highest possible level of health, improve their sanitation, prevent the spread of infectious diseases, and save lives. They have a special duty to the well-being of people whose countries lack the healthcare systems that many of us in the United States and Canada all but take for granted. But today, these organizations are adrift in a sea of political correctitude. Pressured constantly by activist NGOs and foundations, they give lip service to third world needs, but focus primarily on first world concerns like obesity, traffic deaths, cancer, and global warming. Worse, they promote healthcare programs that fail miserably, violate the Hippocratic Oath, and actively harm the people that these agencies were created to help. As to sustainability activists, do you really suppose that Teresa Heinz Kerry, Barbara Streisand, Leonardo DiCaprio, Al Gore, Ted Turner, and any of the lesser eco-scolds are going to give up their mansions, limos, SUVs, private jets, and other accoutrements of their lavish, affluent, elitist lifestyles and set an ever so modest example of sacrifice in the name of the sustainable development that they actively promote so vigorously? Do you imagine, for even a New York minute, that Cameron Diaz and Drew Barrymore are going to go native and actually live for even a week in the squalid conditions they extol in their insipid little program on MTV every week? Do you think they'll live just like the natives, that they want to keep cute, traditional, and indigenous for another century or so? Do you think they'll live in their mud huts, drink their contaminated water, breathe smoke from their wooden dung fires, endure their swarms of tsetse flies and mosquitoes, with no bug repellent, of course, and walk 40 miles to the nearest clinic when they inevitably start convulsing and vomiting with severe malaria in hopes that a nurse there, probably not a doctor, will have some medicines that will actually help them fight their malaria and actually work? This is sustainable development in all its stark reality. It's harmful, I think it's racist, and it's certainly lethal. It's not what you and I would think of as conservation or sustainable development when we just hear the terms. It is a very strong political movement designed more than anything to take control of energy and other natural resources and take decisions out of the hands of the average person on transportation, housing, jobs, anything that we might have as a decision in our own lives. They want control over that. Sustainable development is certainly not environmental justice, human rights, ethics, or social responsibility. It's certainly not the kind of concern for people and the environment that have made you medical professionals and conservationists, that got me involved in the conservation environmental movement, and that reflect our broad concern for people and the environment. I think it suggests that the environmental movement has lost its moral compass. Or as Greenpeace co-founder Patrick Moore, a friend and colleague of mine, has put it, the environmental movement has lost its objectivity, morality, and humanity. The pain and suffering that it is inflicting on people in developing countries must no longer be tolerated. I think we need to focus more on sustaining lives and far less on sustaining these kinds of lethal policies. For the rest of my little talk, I want to address something that I think is hands down the biggest human rights travesty of all these sustainable development hoaxes: the Greens' response to malaria. Now, I have been accused from time to time of getting so wrapped up in this issue that I start to foam at the mouth. And I want to assure you that this is an exaggeration. And to the extent that there is any truth to this accusation, I think it's perfectly warranted. I do get a little hyperventilated about it. I've suffered high fever for days, vomited until I thought I had no stomach left, Fifi Kobasingi, a Ugandan businesswoman and farmer, has told me. It's left me dehydrated, thirsty, and weak, and sometimes I couldn't even tell day from night. My friend's little child hasn't been able to walk for months because of malaria, she told me. She crawls around on the floor, her eyes bulge out like a chameleon, her hair is dried up, and her stomach is all swollen because the parasites have taken over her liver. Her family doesn't have the money to help her, and neither does the Ugandan government. All they can do is take care of her the best they can and wait for her to die. And she did die. The horror of this tragedy is incomprehensible. Malaria infects up to 500 million people a year, half a billion people, more people than live in the United States, Canada, and Mexico combined. It kills 2 million people a year, more people than live in Houston, Texas. The vast majority, almost 90% of all these people, are in sub-Saharan Africa. And nearly 90% of them are children and pregnant women. In Kenya alone, and this is a country of just 31 million people, malaria killed 34,000 children in 2002 and cost the country 170 million lost working days. Ethiopia, Liberia, Tanzania, Uganda, Bolivia, and many other countries also suffer through similar agonies year after year after year. For Africa, this means a third of a country's people can be in bed with malaria at any given time during the malaria season and being cared for by family members and friends who otherwise would be at work themselves. The economic impacts obviously are tremendous. devastating. And in fact, malaria alone costs impoverished Africa at least $12 billion a year. Now, that's not a whole lot in a trillion, multi-trillion dollar economy like the United States has, but for an impoverished subcontinent like Africa's, it's tremendous. To put Africa's situation in context, just imagine what it would be like here in the United States if we had malaria rates comparable to those in Africa. For malaria alone, on a proportional basis, we'd have 100 million sick people and 250,000 dead children each year. Our hospitals would be overwhelmed, our economy in a shambles, and we would demand immediate corrective action with every weapon available, including every pesticide known to man. Malaria is a vicious disease, as many of you are fully aware. Those victims the disease does not kill, it leaves so weak they cannot work, go to school, care for their families, or cultivate their fields, often for weeks or even months on end. Malaria leaves other people with permanent brain damage, or makes them so weak that they die of AIDS or typhus or dysentery and various other serial killer diseases that still stalk these same lands. It depletes scarce healthcare resources that these countries and families need for many other purposes. It is no wonder that Central Africa, where malaria is most prevalent, is also the most destitute region on this impoverished continent. How is this possible? In this age of pesticides and wonder drugs, malaria ought to be the easiest of the three big killers of third world people, the easiest to eradicate. AIDS and tuberculosis are far more complex and harder to address. With malaria, we know how to do it, and we have the weapons, but we have lacked the ethical clarity, the moral courage, and the political willpower to use them. And so we let environmental ideologues in rich, malaria-free countries dictate what ought to be medical decisions made by health ministers in poor, malaria-endemic countries. We let the World Health Organization, UNICEF, World Bank, Wealthy Foundations, and U.S. Agency for International Development tell these countries that they have to rely on bed nets and drug therapies and unproven politically correct concepts known as integrated vector management and capacity building. Never under any circumstances, these poor countries are told, must they use pesticides, especially DDT. Pesticides, the activists insist, would not be sustainable. Well, they're wrong about that. And what I can also tell you is this: without pesticides, the lives of millions of people in these poor developing countries will not be sustainable. Yes, it is true. The United States Environmental Protection Agency banned DDT in 1972. But it did so, as many of you know from reading literature that Jane Orient has sent out and Gordon Edwards has written, it did so for primarily political reasons, in response to Rachel Carson's highly disingenuous book, Silent Spring, and to defuse an unrelenting campaign by Environmental Defense and the good folks who later brought us the LR and Apple scare, the Natural Resources Defense Council, or NRDC. Moreover, EPA banned DDT only after we had used it to eliminate malaria and other killer diseases like typhus and yellow fever in the United States, Canada, Australia, and Europe. So today, American and European activists can afford to oppose DDT. They live in wealthy, malaria-free societies where we still use pesticides to protect people against diseases like West Nile virus. Now, that disease has killed a total of about 700 people in the United States over the last 6 years. Meanwhile, over that same period, malaria killed over 7 million Africans. So the radical activist anti-pesticide jihad has meant that hundreds of thousands of African children and parents die every single year who would live if their countries could use pesticides like DDT. And in fact, since 1972, at least 50 million people have died from malaria alone. That's almost as many as died during all of World War II. Heaven knows how many might have lived if their countries had been able to use DDT. How many might have become the next Nelson Mandela, Kenyan plant geneticist Florence Lambugu, or George Washington Carver. Of course, Rachel Carson never mentioned any of these facts in her book, and why Penguin has just republished it, and why so many high schools and colleges still use it or even recommend or require it is totally beyond my ken. Sprayed in tiny amounts on the walls of homes, this inexpensive miracle pesticide repels mosquitoes for up to 6 months or more. It kills any that land on the walls, and it irritates and bothers those it doesn't kill or repel so that they don't bite. No other pesticide has this triple action feature. No other pesticide at any price is this effective. And used this way on the walls of homes, virtually no DDT even gets into the environment. Moreover, the amounts used in these household spraying programs truly are tiny. In fact, a country the size of Guyana could protect every single citizen in its most malarious zones with the same amount of DDT that American farmers once sprayed on a mere 1,000 acres of cotton. Where DDT is used, malaria cases and deaths plummet. Where it's not used, they skyrocket. South Africa learned this the hard way. After using DDT for many years, as you can see on the left hand of that graph, it got complacent. It bowed to environmentalist pressure and stopped using DDT. It switched to some other pesticides, including synthetic pyrethroids. Within just a couple of years, malaria rates shot from a couple thousand a year to nearly 70,000. So South Africa did the smart thing. It reintroduced DDT for use in spraying the walls and eaves of mud and cinder block homes. It's a program you call indoor residual spraying. In just 18 months, malaria rates plummeted by 80%. It then added a new drug called Coartem, an artemisinin-based combination therapy drug, or ACT drug. And it used this to treat what they now had as a much smaller number of severe malaria cases. In just 3 years, using this combination of drugs and DDT, it cut malaria rates by over 90%. Hundreds of people lived who otherwise would have died. To me, that is the key. You reduce the total number of malaria victims so that every single patient who does get severe malaria can be treated with the best, most effective drugs available on the planet today. South Africa and Uganda understand this, and I cannot understand why these healthcare agencies and other organizations don't grasp this simple medical fact. Why do they let ideology trump evidence, common sense, ethics, medicine, and basic humanitarian principles? The reality is that despite vocal claims to the contrary, DDT is not harmful to humans. Poor nations can afford it. Used properly, it is perfectly safe for the environment. And we knew all this back in 1972 when EPA Administrator William Ruckelshaus banned the chemical. His own scientific panel had concluded that DDT is not carcinogenic. It does not cause mutations or other harm to humans. Used properly, it's not harmful to freshwater fish, estuarine organisms, birds, or other wildlife. But Ruckelshaus ignored all of this. In fact, he never attended a single hour of hearings over a six-month period. And he never read a single page of his own panel's 9,000 pages of reports and testimony. That's why he later admitted that it was a political decision, a decision, moreover, that never gave a moment's thought to how a U.S. DDT ban was likely to send global malaria rates into the stratosphere. And bear in mind, malaria-carrying mosquitoes are far less likely today to build immunities to DDT than to other pesticides, which are still used very heavily in agriculture. And, equally important, even mosquitoes that are resistant to DDT's killer talents are not immune to its very awesome repellent tendencies and properties. But Greenpeace, the Pesticide Action Network, NRDC, the wonderfully named Physicians for Social Responsibility, WHO, USAID, European Union, and other eco-imperialists still oppose DDT. In fact, they go way beyond opposing DDT. Last year, when Uganda's health minister announced that his country was planning to start using DDT again to control malaria, the EU warned that Europe was likely to ban all agricultural exports from Uganda if even a trace of DDT was found on those exports, whether flowers or food exports. And mind you, we can detect one part per billion today, 1 second out of 32 years. And those are the kinds of traces we're talking about. Up to 100,000 Ugandans die every single year from malaria, and the EU is saying they cannot use the most effective weapons available. It's just incredible. Back in the early 1990s, the USAID told Belize it had to stop using DDT or it was going to lose a substantial chunk of its foreign aid. So, of course, Belize caved in, and malaria rates soared. Ecuador has continued to use DDT. They have kept malaria under control. Bolivia caved into various pressures, quit using DDT, and watched its malaria rates go up many-fold. Just this last year, Canada gave $1.5 million to Ethiopia to help it carry out programs under a treaty, the POPs Treaty, so-called, to eliminate the use of certain persistent organic pollutants, including DDT. This is the Stockholm Convention. Now, almost 150,000 Ethiopians die almost every year from malaria. Do the math. $1.5 million, 150,000 dead, $10 per dead person. Not a good bargain in my book. Nor is USAID's current malaria program a whole lot to brag about. Last year, the agency spent $80 million on malaria programs, but 85% of this went to D.C. area consultants, most of them in D.C. area anyway. 10% was devoted to capacity building, and 5% was spent promoting the use of insecticide-treated bed nets, not buying them. In fact, not one dime was spent on actually buying bed nets. Not a dime was spent on drugs. Not a dime was spent on pesticides. Just as appalling, until a year ago, the USAID, WHO, UNICEF, and Rollback Malaria were still promoting, prescribing, and providing Africans with anti-malarial drugs that they had known for years were no longer effective in treating malaria in Africa. In fact, they fail 50 to 80% of the time. To me, that is flagrant medical malpractice. Just imagine one of you guys giving a patient of yours an antibiotic that you knew was likely to be ineffective up to 80% of the time in treating severe pneumonia. You'd get hit by a malpractice suit. So big and fast it would make your head swim, I would think. But in the world of international healthcare, where it's third world children whose lives are at stake, this kind of policy seems to be business as usual. And as Ken pointed out a few minutes ago, typically, government bureaucrats and so forth are simply unaccountable. One other interesting thing about Rollback Malaria, it was launched in 1998. The promise was that by 2010, they would have malaria rates, cut them in half. How have they done? Well, we're 6 years into the program, 7 years into it. Where are malaria rates? They're 10% higher than they were in 1998. Something's obviously not working. And mention DDT to these humanitarians, and all they want to talk about is theoretical risks of using DDT. Just listen to some of the perverse claims that they've used to justify their unconscionable opposition to DDT in countries where malaria is still the biggest single killer of little children. Greenpeace. Measurable quantities of DDT and its breakdown product, DDE, are present in human fatty tissue, blood, and mother's breast milk. Researchers think DDE could be inhibiting lactation because of its estrogen-like effects and may therefore be contributing to lactation failure throughout the world. World Wildlife Fund. Wildlife and people are contaminated by a cocktail of highly toxic chemicals, including DDT. DDT poisons food chains, harms fish. They're saying all this no matter what has come out of the scientific arena. Thins bird eggshells might cause cancer or reduced male hormones in animals and is related to premature births and slow reflexes in babies. Teresa Heinz Carey. Country club women will get a devastating triple whammy from the chemical soup they encounter daily from birth control pills, makeup, sunblock, and daily games of golf on courses that are perfectly manicured thanks to estrogenic chemicals. Physicians for Social Responsibility, once again, studies suggest that DDE and possibly other organochlorines can weaken the immune systems of children, possibly increasing their risk of developing asthma and certain infections. Environmental defense. Chronic low doses of DDT, chronic exposure, are associated with premature birth and low birth weight babies who are exposed to DDT before birth, and with decreased duration of milk supply in nursing mothers. Now, I could point out that not one peer-reviewed scientific study backs up any of these claims. I could bring out H.L. Mencken's comments again about hobgoblins. These claims may not fall into the flat earth category, but they are pure conjecture and fear-mongering. I could point out that premature births and low birth weight babies and lactation problems and weak immune systems are definitely associated with the malnutrition, malaria, and other diseases that are prevalent throughout the Third World. I could remind you that we sprayed every single concentration camp survivor with DDT following World War II to prevent the spread of typhus. We sprayed most of the GIs serving in the South Pacific during World War II with malaria, with DDT to prevent malaria. Mr. Baliunas and my own father were among those folks. We sprayed DDT all over the United States throughout the 1950s and 1960s. I got sprayed to protect crops and eradicate malaria and yellow fever. Not one of these people ever got cancer or any other serious affliction as a result of the DDT. I could also point out that we're talking about very tiny amounts, none of which is likely to get into the environment. But I think Fifi has a better answer. I lost my son, two sisters, and two nephews to malaria. Don't talk to me about birds. And don't tell me a little DDT in our bodies is worse than the risk of losing more children to this killer disease. African mothers would be overjoyed if that were their biggest concern. Fifi might also have noted that dead babies have no reflexes, and that only people in rich, healthy, malaria-free countries can afford to think about these trivial and rather far-fetched claims. And mind you, these are the most horrific things the radical activists have been able to come up with in opposition to DDT. Let's look at this another way. What if your doctor prescribed a medication that, according to the label, could cause anemia, fatigue, nausea, diarrhea, increased risk of infection, fertility problems, fetal defects, or hair loss? Would you take it? Well, what if the benefits were clearly greater than all these risks? For example, what if the drug were your best or your only hope of beating terminal cancer, giving you another month, year, 2 years to live? Of course you'd take it. And chemo drugs do have all these assorted side effects. What if your doctor refused to allow you to undergo chemotherapy because he was afraid you might get diarrhea or your hair might fall out? You'd probably do what I'd do, get another doctor, and wonder seriously about his competence to practice medicine. Now, what if some environmental activist threatened your doctor with legal action to keep her from starting you on chemotherapy because this stakeholder was concerned about the possible side effects, or about the ethics of letting people take such medications, such risky medications? Suppose he told your doctor to employ acceptable alternatives to chemotherapy, things like maybe radical surgery, or extra-strength Tylenol, or more broccoli, or maybe hospice care for your last month or so. A mild reaction would probably be outrage. A normal reaction would be just punch his lights out. This is precisely, I think, the situation faced by hundreds of millions of people in countries that are racked by malaria. They are being told that they cannot use the most effective anti-malaria weaponry available today. Why? Because outside agitators, NGO and WHO stakeholders, hate pesticides and worry about the trivial risks that are virtually irrelevant in contrast to the death and devastation caused by diseases that DDT and other pesticides could prevent. It's no wonder malaria disease and death rates are going out of sight. What drives these inhumane anti-pesticide policies? Never having to worry about getting malaria is certainly one factor. Putting environmental values ahead of almost everything else is another. A third is a fear of chemicals that sometimes borders on the pathological. Another is a tendency to look only at the risks of using these chemicals and never at their benefits. To glorify ultra-precaution over alleged risks from pesticides at the expense of millions of deaths from diseases that the pesticides could prevent. A fifth factor is the double standards that dominate these public policy decisions. For example, zero tolerance for any risk from chemicals, coupled with astounding tolerance for malaria deaths. Or proclaiming that DDT was a failure because it did not completely eradicate malaria in Sri Lanka, for example. And then insisting that insecticide-treated bed nets are a success because they reduced malaria rates by 20% or so in Angola, Cameroon, and Bolivia. Another factor is a determined belief that radical elites have all the answers. And this is a dominant theme of sustainable development theology. And have a right to impose their beliefs, agendas, and ideologies on others, even when the evidence just screams that their policies are a lethal, dismal failure. But you'll have to forgive me if I suspect that another deeper, darker motive may also be at work here. A belief that the world simply has too many people, or that third world lives just aren't as valuable as first world lives and are therefore more expendable. Developing countries would be better off, said one USAID worker, if people were sick with malaria and spread the job opportunities around. In fact, people in the third world would be better off dead than alive and riotously reproducing. Maybe banning DDT would cause a lot of deaths, environmental defense scientist Charles Worster once remarked. So what? People are the cause of all the problems. We have too many of them. And banning DDT is as good a way to get rid of some of them as any. To stabilize world populations, Jacques Cousteau, of all people, once told French magazine Nouvelle Observateur, we must eliminate 350,000 people a day. And Club of Rome founder Alexander King wrote, my chief quarrel with DDT in hindsight is that it greatly added to the population problem. Now, to their everlasting credit, many other people have taken a far more humanitarian and ethical position. The New York Times has said, in a strongly worded editorial or two, the developed world has been unconscionably stingy in financing the fight against malaria or research into alternatives to DDT. Until one is found, wealthy nations should be helping poor countries with all available means, including DDT. There is no charitable way to put it, said the Washington Times. Children are dying, while Westerners worry about fictitious environmental effects. Aid agencies need to drop their opposition to the use of DDT in Africa and encourage the countries now considering using it to do so. Jurassic Park author and PhD molecular biologist Michael Crichton is even more blunt. Banning DDT is one of the most disgraceful episodes in the 20th century history of America, he said. We knew better, and we did it anyway, and we let people around the world die, and we didn't give a damn. Even a couple of Greenpeace and World Wildlife Fund officials have finally begun to recognize reality. If alternatives to DDT aren't working, you've got to use it, said one. If there's nothing else and it's going to save lives, we're all for it, said another one. However, the inflammatory anti-DDT polemics that I just read to you from there are still on their websites, dominating their websites on these issues, and neither group has in any way acknowledged that insecticides have to play a key role in the battle against parasitic and infectious diseases. Now, DDT is certainly not some magical potion that all by itself is going to wipe out malaria and bring health and prosperity to Africa and other countries where the problem is still endemic. But it is a vital weapon in a war against a disease that is carried by many different species of mosquitoes and exists under varied conditions in different countries and even in different regions of the same country. To make it even more of a challenge, both the mosquitoes and the malaria parasites are constantly mutating. So we need every single weapon in our arsenal if we are going to defeat malaria. We need bed nets, larvicides, eliminating standing water around homes and communities. We need more effective drugs, modern homes with screens on windows and doors. We need a malaria vaccine and a full battery of pesticides, including DDT. Decisions about which weapons to use and where and when to use them should be made by health ministers in countries where have malaria problems. They should not be made by anti-pesticide activists and bureaucrats in cozy, air-conditioned, malaria-free offices in Washington, Brussels, or Geneva. It is these health ministers in poor developing countries who have the responsibility to protect their people from killer diseases. They have to have the right to make decisions based on science and medicine and practicality, and without fear of threats or reprisals if their decisions include DDT and other pesticides. This image, by the way, is on the back side of my little t-shirt here. For radical environmentalists and their allies to force people to suffer and die by telling them they must never use DDT and other pesticides, I think, is a moral outrage that we have to challenge with every fiber of our being. Families in developing countries must be allowed, encouraged, and helped to take their rightful place among the Earth's prosperous and healthy people. They need sustained development, not sustainable development. They need a precautionary principle that safeguards them from real, immediate, life-threatening risks, instead of condemning them to poverty, misery, and premature death, to prevent risks that are associated with conjectural or concocted eco-catastrophes. They need abundant, reliable, affordable electricity, the kind that comes from hydroelectric, nuclear, coal, and gas-fired power plants, the kind that cannot come from little solar panels on huts, or even forests of giant bird-killing wind turbines. They need the improved agricultural output and nutrition that can come from modern biotechnology. They need to defeat malaria. Niger Innes, my colleague at the Congress of Racial Equality, puts it this way. There is no more basic human right than to live. Saving, sustaining, and improving lives is the most fundamental form of environmental justice and corporate social responsibility. We all want to protect the environment, but we must stop trying to protect it from distant or imaginary threats. We must stop trying to protect it on the backs and the graves of the world's most powerless and destitute people. Those of us who want pesticides included in the arsenal of disease control programs, who believe poor countries should be able to use DDT in combating killer diseases, we also support all these other malaria control strategies. We believe the WHO, USAID, EU, and other organizations must end their threats and restrictions on the use of life-saving pesticides. Most important, we want progress now, not 10 or 20 or 50 years from now when a vaccine has finally been developed. Sufficient ACT drugs are available to everyone who needs them, water sanitation improves, and modern homes and hospitals that have electricity and window screens and running water finally exist and hopefully exist throughout the third world. Far too many parents and children Far too many Gandhis, Einsteins, Carvers, Tito Puentes, Mandelas, George Washington Carvers will die in the meantime if today's USAID and WHO policies continue to dictate decisions in countries and for countries that are ravaged by malaria. South Africa's experience clearly shows that an 80 or even a 90% reduction in disease and death rates is absolutely possible. These impoverished countries should not have to settle for less and accept far more needless deaths every year. We certainly would not, we should not put them in that position. Simply put, wealthy, malaria-free countries must no longer dictate the malaria control policies of poor malaria-endemic countries. And anti-pesticide NGOs and government agencies must no longer violate the human rights of the poorest, most powerless, and most disease-ridden people on our planet. It is time to end this human rights abuse and restore science, medicine, and humanitarian principles to the policies and operational guidelines of healthcare agencies and environmental NGOs that have perpetrated and perpetuated this needless slaughter. President Bush, just a couple weeks ago, launched a new anti-malaria initiative, millions of additional dollars for the USAID. And several senators are sponsoring bills that would compel USAID to change its policies and start funding pesticide use, indoor residual spraying, DDT use, because USAID is still resistant to doing so. Recently, many of you stepped up to the plate when I asked you to sign a letter from Congress of Racial Equality to President Bush, urging him to take action on this malaria issue. I hope I can count on you again, and if you could please just take a few minutes, write to President Bush, Andrew Natsios, the USAID director, and your senators and congressmen. Tell them pesticides, indoor residual spraying, and DDT must again be made a part of America's public policies to combat malaria and of the strategies developing countries can and need to use to combat it. Tell them USAID and WHO must be made more transparent, must be compelled to support DDT use, and held accountable for the success or the failure of their programs. This is a battle that we can and we must win for human rights and against eco-imperialism. By winning it, we will ensure that millions of people will be alive to thank us. And I thank you for listening, for caring, and for speaking out in support of responsible medicine and effective malaria control programs. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Yeah, Paul, thank you very much. That was one of the neatest speeches I've heard in a long time. Correct me on this, but I'm under the impression that when they were using DDT in the southeastern U.S. and did get rid of malaria in our country, a side benefit, which wasn't published, and correct me on this, is that bird populations in the southeast U.S. went up because they also got rid of avian malaria.
That's true. People forget that we were never a malaria-free country. We had tremendous malaria problems, particularly in places like Washington, D.C., but as far north as Wisconsin, where I grew up, they had malaria epidemics up in Alaska. Yellow fever, dengue fever, typhus, cholera were also big problems. In fact, in 1878 in Memphis, 5,000 people died one summer as a result of yellow fever. It almost wiped out Memphis as a city. It went bankrupt, and people were talking about just plowing the whole area under. Even as late as the 1920s, 7 million Americans were still getting malaria every year. But we used DDT to eliminate malaria, yellow fever, dengue fever, typhus, and other diseases in the United States, and it made a huge difference to our quality of life. And as Alan pointed out, yes, we got rid of avian problems in some of the bird populations. We also killed off some of the insects that were consuming a lot of the food that the birds wanted to eat. So even as Rachel Carson was saying and predicting that bird populations, especially robins, were going to plummet, hence the notion of silent spring, there won't be any birds to sing, those bird populations were actually rising. I've often thought that a good book to write, maybe one of you would like to undertake it, is a sequel to Silent Spring called Noisy Winter. So, Jane?
I understand that dengue fever is not too far from making a comeback in Arizona, and this might help out the pro-DDT campaign. But my question is, you told us about Roy Ennis. Where are Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson and a bunch of other activists who pretend to care about black people?
I think a lot of the other civil rights leaders, so-called, and this is a huge battle all the time between my organization, Congress of Racial Equality, and some of these others, is that these other organizations are still fighting the same old civil rights battles that we won many decades ago and still claiming that whatever problems afflict black or Hispanic and other minority communities in the United States today are still due to racial prejudice rather than things that are endemic within their own communities. We've argued about this long and strong. We hope to bring on board NAACP and Al Sharpton and some of these other people in the coming months. We're going to be making a more concerted effort to do so. But I've wondered the same thing. Same with the Congressional Black Caucus. They just don't seem to understand the severity of this problem or America's role in creating and perpetuating it.
Paul, the Noisy Winter book has almost been written and now published. For the full year prior to Gordon Edwards' death, he and I worked on writing the full Noisy Winter story on DDT and birds from its the very beginning until the present day. We ended up finishing a 29-page paper, which was published a month ago in the Wiley, John Wiley's Water Encyclopedia. Nobody here would want to buy it. The set costs $1,475, but I think you can buy articles for a buck or so online from Wiley. But it's in the section, it's 14 sections to the 5,000-page encyclopedia. In the surface water section is the G. Gordon Edwards story of DDT and aquatic birds. That's how it fit in there. We kind of sneaked it in. But it's absolutely amazing, and it categorizes every single fact of birds, particularly the one about the DDT and the cutout avian malaria, and virtually every bird population you could think of increased during the years of DDT use for the very reason it wiped out the bird problems. And, of course, what the public's been fed is exactly the opposite, that all the bird populations are down. And all the detail, Audubon bird counts every Christmas, are all in the article. It's really awesome for anyone that's interested in reading.
Wow. Thank you. I'd love to see that and hope you do publish your book. And you should call it Noisy Winter. Lost my train of thought on point I was going to make. It'll come back to me in a minute. Alan?
Yes, Dr. Orient mentioned dengue fever. We had a hula troop go down to Tahiti a year or so ago from the Hana district on Maui. When they came home, they brought dengue fever back with them. So we had a little dengue fever epidemic out on the east end of the island of Maui. Fortunately, we were able to isolate it by sending in, we could afford to send in an army of people to go in and look for standing water and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But there you go. Dengue fever is another item.
And dengue fever is not a killer. It hurts.
Yes.
Very painful, but it's not a killer disease the way malaria is. I am picking up reports now that indicate that instead of someone coming to the United States carrying malaria back here from Africa, for example, or Bolivia, and having gotten it there, people are actually contracting it here in the United States because someone has come back carrying the parasite, maybe not knowing it, getting bitten by mosquitoes, and then those mosquitoes are going off and infecting somebody else. So it could become a serious problem here in a short period of time. Fortunately, we have the medical capabilities to address it, and we spray for pesticides on a pretty regular basis. Unfortunately, Fifi Kobasinghe was in New York a couple of years ago for Martin Luther King program at CORE. She had a relapse of malaria. It took her 3 days in New York City to find a doctor who could recognize and treat malaria. And the doctor she found was an African who was doing his residency over here. So that's kind of scary.
I was wondering, this is a friendly... Am I too high up? Okay, thanks. This is a friendly audience. What has been the reception that you have got from organizations like the Sierra Club? And the reason I ask is that my experiences with Sierra Club somewhat parallel yours, and the receptions that I have gotten in other contexts but similar analogous speeches has not been what you would call either friendly or accepting or even courteous. Mm-hmm. So I wonder what your experience has been.
I have an answer to that. I've been on some college campuses. I've talked at the University of Wisconsin. In fact, their C-SPAN taped my two-hour program, half an hour of talk and 90 minutes of Q&A, and broadcasted a number of times on Book TV. I've lectured at University of Minnesota, University of North Carolina. I keynoted a debate on not just this, but the electricity and biotechnology aspects of eco-imperialism at Yale. And I won it by a 3-1 majority after a student vote. The response has been quite positive. I just gave talks last week at Bryn Mawr. And the response basically, I think at the end of my talk, I own the moral high ground. I know there are people in there, because they're pointed out to me, who are from Ralph Nader's PIRGS, from Greenpeace, from Sierra Club, from various other environmental groups, NRDC. I've been asked questions, but they've been respectful. Nobody's come and challenged me or been nasty to me, because by the time I'm done making this kind of a presentation, I think it's pretty obvious what the situation is, what needs to be done about it, that the environmental groups are complicit in it, and they're pretty careful how they respond to me, because I've got them on the run at this point. And I think we can do that on a regular basis. And if we push Congress and we push President Bush and we push especially Andrew Natsios and the World Health Organization and the World Bank, because they all have a lot of people within their organizations who are just absolutely opposed to using pesticides under any circumstances, we can push them into a much more humanitarian, medically based policy. And we need to do that.
Neil. Paul, I believe recently, in the last few months, in a New York Times article, or maybe it was the magazine section, that Ruckelus was interviewed, and he admitted that that it was Richard Nixon, before the EPA was even while it was being conceived, it was Richard Nixon who more or less ordered him to hold hearings on DDT because they were planning on banning it. Mm-hmm. Now, with that in mind, I would like to see what your opinion would be, because the left and the all the ecology groups are primarily creatures of the left, and they hate Nixon. Would this be a kind of a back way door to try to get some support?
I've thought that same thing, and you're right. It's hard to say whether it was Nixon or it was Ruckelshaus. Ruckelshaus is saying, well, I was ordered to do it. I'm not sure about that, because Ruckelshaus is a card-carrying member and active fundraiser for NRDC at the time he made this decision. Mm-hmm. He didn't reveal that. It didn't come out until a year or two later. But it's nice for him to be able to say, Richard Nixon ordered me. I've often thought that if the mere fact that Nixon had a role in this should be reasons for all the liberals to say, now I am in favor of DDT. But I don't think it quite works that way. You're talking about a marvelous article by Tina Rosenberg that was in the New York Times Magazine, and I have it posted on my eco-imperialism website. New York Times has been surprisingly supportive of this. Washington Post, on the other hand, has typically gone out of its way to publish anti-DDT stuff. Washington Times, just the opposite of that, very pro. Chicago Sun-Times, Forbes Magazine, the Wall Street Journal, all kinds of newspapers and magazines have taken a stance similar to what I was quoting here from some of the magazines and from Michael Crichton. So there is a lot of support out there for doing the right thing. It's a matter of pushing a few folks over that edge.
And I think you might also like to tell the audience about your street theater and what you've done with CORE
I'll mention that. I will mention again, I've got some copies of my book here and some of my T-shirts, so if anybody wants some of those, come see me later on. Street theater something I got involved in when I was in college, and it's kind of fun to go back to those roots sometimes and use it opposing some of these very organizations that I once was a part of, and they just don't know what to do with it. A couple of years ago, Greenpeace held a little rally in Liberty Park, New Jersey. Run for Life, they called it. They were going to trot out their troops and fundraise and get members by opposing chemicals. All of a sudden, in the middle of their rally, two buses pulled up, and about 200 mostly black folks got out, African tribal regalia, drums, stilt walkers, and they were talking about Greenpeace's Run for Death and calling attention to the impact that people in Greenpeace and these other organizations were having on the poorest people on the planet. Fall of 2003 in Cancun, WTO conference, we staged another event complete with black coffins, people in death masks and Grim Reaper costumes, same message. Just a couple months ago, in front of the J.P. Morgan Chase Bank in New York, Rainforest Action Network was there campaigning to shut down J.P. Morgan, force them to kowtow to Rainforest Action's positions on global warming, timber harvesting, sustainable development. They ended up getting J.P. Morgan to cave in because J.P. Morgan is too chicken to stand up to them. But we had about 30 core counter-demonstrators there making these very same points. And I think that, at some level, I don't like that kind of stuff because it breaks away from the science. I was a science major in college, and a lot of us have that antipathy or reservation about using street theater, but the reality is that it can call attention to you, the media pays some attention to you, and then you can get out your science and medicine message, your human rights message, and to me, this is the key thing. I gave Patrick Moore a copy of my manuscript a couple of years ago, and he gave me that quote that I used. It's on the back of my book here. But I had asked him a question: how can we little people, without the billions and billions of dollars, but roughly an $8 billion annual treasury that these environmental groups have for their propaganda programs, how can we do battle with them? And he said, what you have to do is call attention to the impact that these organizations are having on the children and parents, the poorest people on the planet. At that point, I gave him my manuscript. A couple days later, he gave me that marvelous quote about losing its objectivity, morality, and humanity. And someone who comes out of the Greenpeace movement, who founded Greenpeace, helped launch the environmental movement back in the early 1970s, that's an incredible change. He just never lost touch with his real roots and the real purpose that he was involved in from the get-go on environmentalism, which was to protect people and planet. And he just got disgusted with the lies and the misrepresentations and the callous attitude that he was encountering all the time from his fellows in Greenpeace and these other organizations, and he had a very forceful break. There's actually a website, if it's still up, I'm not sure, but it was called PatrickMooreIsABigFatLiar.org because they don't like him.
Yeah, I was at that. I was in the room when President Bush made that announcement on the aid.
Oh, you were.
And previous to that, to the starting that meeting, I had met with some people who were very interested in using DDT to fight malaria. I know that when he made his announcement, I think there were some very disappointed people that he didn't say that he was going to ask for DDT. We kind of got the same old bed netting story and things like that. And I kind of think that. If someone like Angela Jolie can stand up at Davos and talk about bed netting and stuff like that, you would think the President of the United States would want to go in a different direction and try something stronger. What does he have to risk at this stage of the game for him, politically, by going ahead and just let's go out on a limb, let's go for it?
It's a good question, and I don't know. He has a few people within USAID like Dennis Carroll, who are rabidly anti-pesticide. They're absolutely convinced that all they have to do is make more bed nets available. Bear in mind, you've got in sub-Saharan Africa roughly 1.5 billion people at risk of getting malaria. 500 million, 95% of them, over 400 million at least every year are getting malaria. They're talking very proudly about having gotten bed nets to 30 or 40 million people. They got a long way to go. And then you've got to have people use them every single night. Drugs, they're pushing ACT drugs, growing more artemisinin. That's nice. They think within 5 years they'll be able to have enough drugs to reach 40 million people a year. Well, that still leaves 460 million people that you're not reaching with them. You've got to get the level of malaria down so that you can get good drugs to people that need them.
Yes, the last couple of years I've noticed the increase, it seems to be of a concern, to West Nile virus in the United States. And if I'm under the correct impression, that's also transmitted by mosquitoes. And I hear on network radio quite a bit now, they're selling preparations for West Nile virus for your horse. Apparently it attacks the horses. So anyway, even in my home state of North Carolina, we seem to be having an increase, you know, like 10, 15 cases now the last couple of years, which is a lot compared to zero in the last 10. Sure. Could you comment on that a little bit?
Yeah. You're right. West Nile has been a bit on the increase. It's one of the reasons they spray so often, aerial spraying in the Dade County area, for example, not just for West Nile, of course, but one of the other reasons is tourists don't want to come to Florida and get bitten by mosquitoes, whether or not they're carrying West Nile. But if they are, they've got serious questions about coming to Miami. The horse population is very definitely at risk. And what's interesting is a couple of years ago, some activists up in New York, when they were experiencing some serious West Nile problems, said, listen, what's all the fuss about? It's only killing a few people a year, and it's the people that are dying are just children and old people. So what's all the fuss? It's a marvelous quotation. And these are the same people who go bonkers over the merest trace of mercury, for example. So I find it hypocritical, disingenuous, and unbelievably callous. Not a tremendous reflection on concern about people. A couple more questions, and then we can call it quits. Yeah, that's right. It's transmitted by mosquitoes, but carried largely by birds, but it's also being transmitted to people. If someone has West Nile as a person or a horse, it's going to get picked up by a mosquito that bites them, carried to the next one. So, yes, it is a major killer of birds. And again, these are folks who evince tremendous concern about bird populations. If they're going to be harmed by drilling in Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, for example, or drilling anyplace else, but this they view as a natural cycle. I've even seen a quotation about sleeping sickness, trypanosomiasis, in Africa by an environmentalist who says this has always been an issue. It's natural. It's part of the natural eco-cycle in Africa, and we should not try to eradicate sleeping sickness and tsetse flies from Africa. So some strange attitudes. Yeah.
In 1951 and 52, Florida sprayed the entire East Coast with DDT every afternoon. I lived there then.
Yeah, it wasn't just Florida. Yeah, a lot of us lived through that and lived through it and didn't get cancer and didn't get anything else, maybe a little chloracne in a few instances where we got too much of it. But bear in mind what I said. Every concentration camp survivor, most of our GIs in the South Pacific, most every survivor of World War II in Germany and Italy to control typhus. And nobody came down with anything. The environmental impacts, A, were grossly overstated or non-existent. B, they occurred at a time when a lot of DDT was mixed with petroleum distillates instead of with water to spray it. And C, at a time when there was tremendous pollution entering our waterways and our airways from all different sources. So it's very hard to say DDT was responsible for this or that or the other thing when there were so many actors involved and when we were using DDT. Sort of the attitude was, gosh, if a teaspoon works this well, a barrel ought to work a lot better. And those attitudes prevailed for a long time, and I think we're far more responsible in all our pesticide use. But again, we're talking about spraying the homes of people who are in malarial areas and saving millions of lives, and I just cannot fathom the opposition that still is out there against DDT and other pesticides. One more here, yeah, Alan, and we'll quit.
Quickly, you mentioned typhus. I understand that in World War I, more soldiers died from typhus than from bullet wounds.
Yeah.
Is typhus sort of lying dormant? Could it come back?
I haven't seen a whole lot about typhus outbreaks. We usually get into areas where there's danger of typhus or cholera and bring in the pesticides, whether or not they're DDT. They were talking about cholera and typhus and malaria outbreaks in the wake of the Asian tsunami and bringing in DDT, but they got there early enough with a lot of stuff and kept those diseases under control. But yeah, you're right. Typhus was a big killer. Malaria was as well here in the Western Hemisphere. Napoleon sent 70,000 troops to Haiti and Louisiana before he sold Louisiana to the United States. Within a year, 23,000 of them had died of malaria. That was one of the main reasons he sold us the Louisiana area. So it's a big problem, and we've got it under control in a lot of places. We could get it under control in Africa. Thanks so much. You've been a great audience.